It's like the drunk in the lamppost problem. The last talk was giving an excellent review of the temperature of that part of the interstellar medium which we see in the Lyman Alpha forest. But we know there are other parts, for example, galaxies, it's colder than that. Clusters of galaxies, it's hotter than that. We see X-rays. And so you'd for a more complete picture, you know there are several components. So you say, how would you really describe it? Well, the minimum description that you'd need to know is temperature, density, and metallicity as a function of redshift. But you'd also want to know that's not the one-point functions, but the correlations, and the correlations with dark matter and galaxy distributions. And even if you had, even if I knew all the answers to these questions, I couldn't possibly convey the multidimensional discussion of it. So I'll show you pictures in part. But it helps to break down the gas into several components. And the crudest one is the cool gas and stars 10 to the fifth, and that's what the last talk was on, which is detected in the optical, but also in some cases in the radio. The next component I'm calling warm-hot, and I'm defining that to be between 10 to the fifth and 10 to the seventh, that you could see in some optical absorption and X-ray, soft X-ray emission. And then finally, we know there's a very hot component which is seen in hard X-ray emission. The good measurements of these two, and they're tentative detections, and some upper bounds on the intermediate category. What are the physical processes? We just had a good discussion of the physical processes in the cool gas. It's radiative line cooling and heating is essentially it. In the warm hot gas, it's radiative and continuum cooling plus shock heating of two kinds, supernova and gravitational. And for the very hot gas, radiative continuum, i.e. bremsstrahlung, back to the coma cluster gas, and gravitational shock heating. I want to say a word about this process because it's not that familiar to people. Sound waves can steepen and turn into shocks. So can any gravitational perturbation cause shocks when the potential in the perturbation is higher than the temperatures that we were just talking about 10,000 degrees or so. And we know that velocities of galaxies are greater than that. They're hundreds of kilometers per second. So gas is moving around at hundreds of kilometers per second, and therefore it will tend to shock. And if it does shock, it'll come to a sound speed afterwards, which is going to be for 800 kilometers per second, it'll be 1 keV. For a few hundred kilometers per second, you can scale it down. So you know this must be the case, since you see that's the velocities of galaxies and the velocities of your set particles. Now, there's a simple way of saying what you'd expect. If you take the wavelength, which is nonlinear, which right now is about 8 megaparsecs, times the Hubble constant, you get something with a unit of velocity, and that is the temperature of the shocked gas. And that goes up with time. So the shock gas will go up in time with temperature. Let me turn now to the simulations which try to model all this and say about a word about the parameters free and other non-free. There are lots of parameters that one has to put in a simulation aside from the standard cosmological parameters. But there are fewer free parameters than there are parameters. If you think about it, each high-mass star produces a certain amount of metals, a certain amount of energy in the UV and the optical, and a certain amount of supernova energy. And you look up detailed papers on, I'm just giving rough orders of magnitude here, on exactly what this would be. If you take a spectrum of stars with a Salpeter function, then all the ratios for those, for the set, are fixed. And so if you were to say in the end that you made a certain amount of mass into stars, then you could parameterize all of this by saying you made a certain amount of mass into metals, and I'll just call this Y, the yield. But then the optical output of the simulation would be fixed, the metallicity of the gas would be fixed, and the supernova feedback would be fixed for any star formation. We took y of 0.02, which is what you get out from the Sylvia calculations. So that's one free parameter, essentially. And you fix that essentially to get the metals right. So let me now turn to the results again. I'll show lots of pictures of the distribution. Then there's some kind of quantitative with numbers, and then tests. And I'll say just a very little bit about the model, the computation. It's a standard model, the same thing that Paul Steinhardt and I did in 95. So it's a lambda CDM model. Kobe and cluster normalized. And the new results I'll be showing are from a recent simulation, not that picture, which has a resolution of about 7.5 kiloparsecs at a redshift of 3. Now, to show that it gives reasonable results, this is not, in fact, the Medal plot from that paper, but from that simulation, but from an earlier one. But we get a star formation rate, which goes through the conventional points. It essentially agrees. The turn down at low redshift has a reference to what we're talking about in this particular talk, what kills star formation at late times and galaxy formation is that, in general, the highest rates of galaxy formation are going on in the highest density parts of the universe. But at late times, the highest density parts of the universe are in clusters of galaxies. We know that's the highest density regions we see, where the temperature is extremely high. And in those cases, you don't get any galaxy formation. The gas can't cool. So that explains the turn down in the simulations at that point. Just as a sanity check, what does it compute for the user background? And this is the convention of J21. And it shows it's giving a value about what people have gotten from observations at a redshift of a few, J21 of a few tenths, and then declining rapidly towards the present. And then, since there's been a lot of discussion about the assumed spectrum, and Al talked about it, the last paper talked about it, is it hard, is it soft, this is what our computed spectrum is. And, for example, this is the effect that was just described, where it goes down at the Lyman break, then up, and then down at the helium, and then up again. And you can read off. What this comes from is taking a mixture of quasars and stars, but it's very independent of the initial input, as long as there's some quasars. And it's mainly the processing of that through the source function, through the absorption of the intergalactic medium. And, of course, the intergalactic medium you have to have come out right to give you the right Lyman alpha cloud. But it has a spectrum. And the only difference between this and what's in Chan and Oestreich in 1992 is that the printers have gotten better, so the lines are a little thinner. But aside from that, the physics is the same and the result, so not everyone was assuming a power law. So now let me just show pictures, if we can have the lights a little bit lower. So here's the general gas density first at redshift 3, and those with really sharp eyes can see the little red dots in the middle of these filaments. And those red dots tend to be Lyman break or damp Lyman alpha systems, the Lyman limit systems or damp Lyman alpha. The bulk of the Lyman alpha, intermediate calm density Lyman alpha clouds are coming from this greenish region here. And so this is redshift 2. This is total, and you see there's a rich region forming. I'm not showing it at a given temperature here. And I'll go forward to redshift 0. And at redshift 0, you notice a fair fraction of it in the 25 megaparsec box, the total gas is in a few big lumps. and then a lot more and smaller ones. In this size box, this bigger one might be like the Virgo cluster. There's nothing as bright as the Coma cluster. Now let's look at neutral hydrogen. And this is redshift 3. This doesn't look all that different from the first one I showed, because most of the gas was neutral hydrogen. This is a lot of alpha 5 in a fair amount of detail. And then it breaks up into smaller lumps with time. And I'll just move this to redshift 0. And you see that at redshift 0, it's lots of little individual lumps which are in the vicinity of or surrounding galaxies, not always the brightest galaxies. Now let me turn to the temperature, and there you can see the shocks developing. They develop better in a shock capturing code like Brian and Norman's and ours than in the SBH codes, but all of them find this. And you see these regions where the shock is propagating out from regions where the material was colliding. Here's the same at redshift 1. And then if I go to redshift 0, you did it so well. At redshift 0, the volume in these shocked regions is large. Now, if a galaxy was in one of these regions, it's not going to do very much. This is the highest density regions, but star formation and galaxy formation is now cut off quite these points. And there's a reasonable fraction of the volume and a larger fraction of the mass that is in such shocked regions. And this is probably, the red is probably 10 to the 7. I guess 10 to the 5. Now let me take more detail at one intermediate redshift. So this is a redshift of 2. And look at the metal. And if you were to see where the galaxies are, it's lumps around the galaxies, and I'll try to explain the physics of that later. This is where the cold gas is. The smoothish background here is the low column density Lyman alpha clouds, and the little red dots are the Lyman limit systems and the damp Lyman alpha clouds. This is the intermediate temperature gas, 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 7, at that redshift. And this is the hot gas, greater than 10 to the 7th, so you're beginning to form some clusters. Now, overall, if you were to just mindlessly average over everything and say, what's the average temperature, this is the beginning part is from the last talk, just our numerical rather than the hand-drawn one that you showed. Here's the adiabatic expansion of the universe. Here's photoheating, and the ionized and the volume weighted and the mass weighted are very similar temperatures during the photoheating and photoionization part. But after the shocks start to take off, the mass weighted temperature is growing much faster than the volume weighted temperature. This, of course, still doesn't include if I took the background temperature of the ionized gas, that would be here, and it would be exactly as described in the last paper. What about reionization? Again, the first reion is helium at a redshift of 9. Then hydrogen fairly sharply at a redshift of 8. And then helium 2, and we don't have any adjustable parameters. We saw in the last that it seemed to empirically occur at a redshift of 3, And that's what we're finding, the helium-2 ionization is occurring. I'm just picking out this point here at about a redshift of 3 just to guide the eye. So it seems to reproduce that observed fact. What about the distribution of metallicities? For both the Lyman alpha damp and all the gas, the metal evolution is fairly small. In other words, if I were to take, this is the integral metal distribution, metals versus a fraction of the mass in that form. If I were to take, while at any given time there's a huge range of metals, in other words, by reading off any of these lines, if I were to take the half point and see how much this evolves in either the damp Lyman alpha systems or the average of the gas, the evolution is fairly slow. So the evolution of time of the metals is, there's a very large dispersion, but the evolution of time is slight. This is apropos of what Hinault's taught this morning. He showed that you needed a large dependence of metallicity on density, and at redshift 3, he showed you needed a very steep power law. Well, this is what we compute. At redshift 0, it's there as well. In the high density regions, it hasn't gone up all that much. In the low density regions, it's gone up a lot. And in the paper that we wrote on cosmological evolution about a year and a half ago, the point we tried to make was that the evolution in time of the metallicity is much, much less than the evolution in space at any given time. It's mainly a function of density. And then what about the different components? This, bizarrely enough, has turned out to be a controversial matter. Let's look at the fraction of the volume in these three components. So this is the gas that was talked about in the last talk. At redshift 3, it's almost all the volume. And at redshift 0, it's still 90%. So in volume-weighted averages, you're still talking about the universe. You don't have to talk about the IgM or even the photoionized. It's right for all. Well, there's some fraction of the baryons in galaxies. But the volume fraction is negligible. And then there's some fraction in clusters at greater than 10 to the 7th. That's still pretty small in volume. And then there's a growing fraction that's intermediate. What do we find if we look at the mass-weighted values? Well, the fraction in the photoionized component is dropping like a shot with time just because it's getting shock-heated to larger and larger temperatures. The fraction of the baryons in stars has gone up. The fraction of the mass in the hot component has gone up to between 10 and 20%. That's known. That is the fraction in clusters of galaxies. We shouldn't be surprised that the fraction of gas in the intermediate bin between this bin and this bin has also gone up. And we find that it's a little more than half is in this warm-hot gas, which should be detectable by a variety of different means. Then you can say, well, what do other people find? Here's two simulations by Brian and Norman. One of them is, and that's an adaptive mesh code of an open dark matter model. Here's another one of theirs with a mixed dark matter model. So they get 60% or 40%. The SPH group here gave me a figure from Dave, and it's the same fractions. The plots are the other way around, but they get about 35% in the warm. Again, a declining fraction of the hot, increasing fraction of the warm. The picture over there that I've shown is the warm component, and that's where most of the volume is. If you were to try to look hard at this, again, you'd see little red dots in it, and those are invariably where galaxies are. If it depends how you look at it, emission or absorption. If you looked at it in absorption, it would look very much like this, and you'd see filaments. If you looked at an emission, since it goes as rho squared, you'll basically see the yellow regions are little red dots. Let me say a word about the distributions in space of these components. I was up to all hours making this pretty picture. It's more fun than using a color printer. So, paint by the numbers, my own semi-analytic modeling. So here's a slice through a 50 by 50 megaparsec box. I think it's a 10 megaparsec slice, and just showed three sets of contours. The red is the contours in this box, in this slice of this warm, hot gas. So 10 to the 5th, 10 to the 7th. The galaxies are all half of the galaxy, so half of that gas is within that set of contours. Half of the galaxies are within these black spots. And half of the metals in this, the metals in the gas are in the green regions. So one shouldn't be surprised if when one takes a line of sight that goes through and sees a metal line system, then one doesn't have to go very far from that to see a galaxy. Now you can ask, this was discussed earlier, and what's the physics of this? Does this have something to do with feedback processes, etc.? I don't think it very much does. And there's a very simple astronomical argument on that. If you look at matter leaving galaxies, right near the galaxies, it might have 1,000 kilometers per second. After it mixes with the intergalactic medium, it's only a few hundred kilometers per second. It can't get more than a few hundred kiloparsecs in Hubble time. So it's not, whatever the mechanism is driving out in galaxies, it's not winds, etc., from galaxies that populated these regions, which are larger than the regions where the galaxies were. Basically, what one needs is a high-resolution simulation with high K, initial wave number, which allows for all the small objects that formed early and which made stars from little dwarf or sun-interesting systems and sprayed them out in the regions along the ridge lines of which the galaxies will form. And that's, in fact, what does this, not feedback. We can turn on and off the feedback. We get similar results for the metallicity distribution. You have to get it. If it were all never got out of the smallest, even the smallest galaxies, you're right. There would be nothing in the IGM. But for widespread distribution, the overall distribution is not set by that, but by where it's made. Let me just conclude on the baryons. The Lyman alpha component declines rapidly in the simulations. That's pretty much known. The very hot phase grows rapidly towards Z equals zero. That's pretty much known. The prediction then is that this intermediate component grows and dominates at Z equals zero. You can test with soft X-ray autocorrelation on the sky. Galaxy soft X-ray cross-correlation. There's a paper about 4 years ago by Zoltan, Hasinger, and I can't remember all the authors, which found just such a correlation between the galaxies and the soft X-ray background, which meant that it wasn't quasars, and it wasn't background, and it wasn't foreground, and they attributed it to this. And there are various absorption and emission line probes. Jordi Meralda proposed a test using X-ray or their optical elements. On the metal distribution, there's a very large variance at all redshifts. I think we know that. Take redshift zero. We have very high metallicity systems, and we have very low gas regions. At high redshifts, we have the quasars. The central regions are very high. A rather mild mean evolution of metals with redshift, that's the dependence of Z on Z, which you'd think would be a straight line, but there's a difference in size, which allows some variance. The strong Z metallicity dependence on the density, this is fairly testable. Another point is that the metals evolve early in high overdensity regions and late in low overdensity. And there should be a strong, and this is pretty obvious, correlation of the metals with the galaxies, but a correlation that has nothing to do with feedback. That could probably be tested by looking at the type 1 and type 2 supernova elements in the metals, because the metals that would be in the region surrounding are probably from first-generation stars, whereas the metals in the galaxy have been fairly processed. That's all I have to say. Thank you. Everyone stunned into... Paul?
Jerry? Are you finding that the helium-2 reionizes at redshift 3 independent of whether there are quasars early on? Or do you see a difference in the reionization redshift?
We didn't turn them off. My guess is it would depend on the quasars. But we haven't tried it.
So these
runs, the quasars are there.
They were.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's because all the high-energy radiation, this is what I was saying, people confuse the source function. Yeah. If I can, if anybody can see, if I could do a blackboard. But dj dt is minus jh Hubble constant minus a kappa j plus a source function. And people confuse the evolution of the source function of the evolution of the radiation field. We can involve the two together, but it's going to be whatever the source function is, it's going to be the resulting radiation field is very soft at high redshift just because of the opacity dependence on nu and the higher density of the intergalactic medium. If you just put in a power law, of course, you don't find that.
You were saying that the metals don't actually come out of the big galaxies, but they're just the remnants of the smaller galaxies
right.
earlier. So I was wondering if this helped with the problem that was discussed earlier about having to form a quiescent IGM that was also metal enriched.
Yeah, I think it solves it. they do obviously have to get out, is the point, but they don't have to get out very far.
This question is perhaps for Tom Abell or Martin Hainelt, but you know, in general, the other groups haven't used a power law. They've used the Hart-Madow spectrum, which takes a source function and convolved it with the opacity from the observed Lyman alpha forest. So basically, these effects should be there. But then, so the question is, if that spectrum was actually far off, what did Hart-Madow get wrong?
The helium opacity by scaling from the lime from the hydrogen opacity. That's the only information they had. And if you would just take the helium opacity, that wouldn't be consistent with what you actually see in the helium lime alpha forest, for example. So they have a very weak Forr-Rydberg break and no steep recovery afterwards. So they have a very it's basically the Forr-Rydberg break is too weak in the spectrum because of an underestimate of the helium opacity. But you can't blame
we don't assume equilibrium.
You can't
we actually integrate for each species in each cell at each time.
So they just did the simple scaling from the lime alpha opacity to the helium lime alpha opacity.
You showed some mild enrichment of the very low overdensity material at redshift of 3. Can you comment on how you do the enrichment without shock heating it? Because it looks like as if the temperature didn't get that high.
That is a good question. My guess is that it's small galaxies that were in those regions which just ejected a little bit of metals, but not enough to affect things very much. But I would have to look in detail. Because you find dwarf systems throughout the volume. What? 10 to the, in stellar mass, 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8 in stellar mass. A couple of orders of magnitude more. Because the dark matter dominator.